Speaker Brian Bosma announces his retirement. The Red for Ed rally takes over the State House, plus Vice President Pence name-dropped in the impeachment hearings, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending November 22, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Hoosiers learned there will be a new leader of the Indiana House in the coming months as Brian Bosma, the longest-serving speaker in state history, announced his retirement. Brian Bosma, a Republican, has been a state lawmaker for 34 years and served as speaker for 12 of the last 16. 2020 will be his last session, a choice he says was a difficult one, but Bosma says he's proud of his accomplishments.
Choice for children and families, low-income families, turning Indiana's economy around, having real balanced budgets.
Bosma says the House GOP caucus will choose a speaker-elect in the next few weeks who will take over the chamber at the end of the 2020 session.
Our leadership team will probably coalesce around a single individual, I would think, but that decision's not been made yet.
Praise for Bosma's legislative service came in from many corners, including the governor and the leaders, both Democrat and Republican, of the state legislative caucuses. What does Bosma's retirement mean for Indiana? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, Bosma was and is a towering figure at the Statehouse. What will his departure mean for the legislature and the state?
Is that a reference to his size?
No, he's a pretty powerful figure.
He is, and he's been able to keep that caucus in relatively good order. And considering some of the members of that caucus, that's no small achievement.
And its size. At one time, 73 members,
right.
Just a few years
and
ago.
And it'll be less than that after the next election. So, you know, he deserves a lot of credit for what he was able to do after all of those years. I find it a little ironic, though, that he gives the same speech every year. The speech he gives every year is that before the Republicans took over, there was chaos and anarchy, and we were on the end of doom.
Well, that's true. You gotta
and they ran in, and they did everything, and it's now utopia. I don't know why they meet every year, because everything is perfect
now. There are
now.
Some lawmakers who wonder that same question, quite frankly.
You know, we don't
including
have,
the guy
we
who
don't,
may be the next speaker. He's got a bill every
that's
year.
That's actually...
We don't have to pay our teachers. We don't have to deal with the opioid crisis. Our roads are in great shape. Higher education is fully funded. I don't know why we have a legislature.
What is
it's like you wrote the speech.
I could probably give it by heart. I've heard it so many times.
What does Bosma's departure mean for that caucus and the Indiana House?
You know, it occurred to me in thinking this through this week, we have two leaders, Rod Bray in the Senate and Brian Bosma in the House, both of whom took their father's seats. So from a very young age or birth, they were part of this process. And you see that play out in how they manage their caucuses, how they manage the process. I think, you know, you can talk to Democrats who believe that during Speaker Bosma's time as Speaker, they didn't win much because the Republican majorities were so large, but they never felt like they were shut out or locked out of the process, right? There was a fair shake, and what I think you can attribute that to is this kind of, and what we're losing in these institutions is a respect for process and a respect for how these issues are managed, and particularly how very controversial issues are managed through the process. You know, Speaker Bosma in particular protected that body from making tough votes when maybe fringe members would introduce legislation that was mm-hmm. that if it comes to the floor maybe it has to pass, but it really shouldn't. And that it took a lot of finesse and political skill to do that, and Speaker Bosma developed that over time. You could see it, and it certainly over the last 10 years put it in practice. I think the one other thing, if you look at the House Republican Campaign Committee and how he came to power, yeah. There's a reason he's that powerful, and it's because he went and created these majorities and recruited these people and ran the campaigns.
But doesn't
it mattered a lot.
It matters a lot, though, who his successor is, too.
It does.
And whether that person can do the same kinds of tasks.
Well, I think some of it, no matter, likely.
Yeah, it does seem like it's moving in the direction of Todd Houston or Fisher's representative, although Todd Houston will have, and probably will likely have for a while, tough races for re-election in his own seat, as opposed to Brian Bosma, who's had comfortable margins for quite some time.
had is the operative word.
Yeah, they were
too.
Starting to get closer. Brian Bosma had served in the legislature for a long time before he became Speaker. And before he became Speaker again in this current run, had been there even longer. It's unlikely that his replacement, whoever they are, is going to have that much legislative experience. And certainly, to your point, Mike, going back even further than that, just being around the process.
Yeah.
So even if it's Todd Houston, say, who's philosophically probably in line with Brian Bosma, will that lack of just literal experience be a detriment to the caucus and to the chamber?
Well, my sense is that when you're in a leadership position trying to herd the proverbial cats in any caucus in the legislature, experience is a valuable commodity. It's a situation where he's seen a lot over the years. He's dealt with any number of scenarios and problems that have popped up, and some of which we probably will never know until he writes the tell-all book, which would be very interesting. I'll be in line
to buy that book.
That's one of the things I would say, that we don't know. We give him a lot of credit, and he deserves it, but there's probably a lot of things he's done that he prevented from happening that would have been an embarrassment for the caucus or for the state. You know, in Brian Bosma, I think you have somebody who, because of his experience, is somebody who was a traditionalist. And by that I mean he recognized and appreciated what came before and had a respect for what would follow. And I say that, that seems like maybe an obvious statement, but you have periodically members, politicians who seek office basically as if they have, you know, torches that they want to come and burn down whatever institution that they're seeking to seat they're seeking to occupy. It's almost a, you know, slash and burn approach. He's somebody who I think has an appreciation of the institution and what makes it work, and an appreciation and tolerance for compromise.
We've talked on the show before about the more extreme versions of legislation that we see around the country than those we've seen here. Leaping to mind, gun measures that we've seen authored certainly in Indiana, but never gotten even a committee hearing, let alone a floor vote. Same thing with a total abortion ban. With Brian Bosma no longer at the helm, are we about to see some of those things get a lot further than they ever have?
They might. They'll certainly get hearings, possibly. I mean, whoever takes over obviously won't have the experience that Bosma did, so they're going to make some mistakes. It's just going to happen.
Early on.
Exactly. It's, you know, how they learn from that. And I have to be honest, as far as I can tell, it's Todd Houston's, you know, role to lose. I think some people are a little nervous, though, about where that leaves the fiscal stuff, because Todd Houston handled so much last year with the gaming bill and the budget and, you know, other things that, you know, they're kind of taking one of their strong people kind of off the board.
Yeah, Doc's back, though. I mean, Doc's back to full strength.
I think when we were talking about the lack of, or relatively lack of experience, I think Bosma's smart in one sense to have a speaker-elect and have him up there with him during the session and hopefully avoid some of the pitfalls that beset him early in his career.
Yeah, David Long tried to do something similar, but it was after the session.
Correct.
So it wasn't through the session where you really got to learn on the job the way that presumably whoever the speaker-elect will be able to do. So a sea of red flooded through downtown Indianapolis this week, demanding lawmakers increase funding for public education and ease burdens on educators. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Allison Zeihammer reports.
An estimated 15,000 educators wearing red surrounded the Indiana State House during the Red for Ed rally, carrying signs and chanting support. More than 140 school districts canceled classes, and educators attended from across the state. Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick spoke at the rally and says educators want adequate and equitable funding, flexibility in professional development, and fair accountability. McCormick says it's taking lawmakers way too long to make these changes.
Our students deserve every bit of this advocacy that you see, but it is a shame that it takes this type of advocacy to get what our students deserve.
Mike O'Brien, let's come to the fundamental question. Will this rally have an impact on the 2020 session?
I think it already has. I mean, the three things that they've asked for, an increase in compensation and reduction in administrative burdens through this externship and not being penalized for the iLearn issue. The iLearn issue, they've already said we're not penalizing teachers for that. So they've achieved that was right. You know, Governor Holcomb and the legislature have focused on teacher pay. They increased funding $1.6 billion since 2017, and we're seeing it. We're seeing IPS, probably the biggest example of the biggest increase
A big part of that was the referendum, and not part of it.
But you can look at other parts of the state, and you see the school boards take some of that, take that increase in money, and put it towards compensation because some incentives were put in place to do that. So I think Governor Holcomb certainly has leaned into this. A lot got done last session. More is going to get done in the future as this panel continues to look at teacher compensation and how to do it and how to get more money to the paycheck, which isn't easy in just one budget either.
It's supposed to be a plan for future multiple.
I mean, if that many people
budgets.
Showed up at their school board hearing, they'd have a raise, and it wouldn't be close.
Do you think this rally will have
a significant
impact?
I think it will, and I think the teachers need to realize that they have to change their structure. They have to be statewide. That's where success has worked in other jurisdictions, where they were as a mass. Now, this is a very encouraging turnout, no question about it, and if they carry it to the ballot box, you know, you've got all of those teachers and their spouses or significant others and mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers, that becomes a fairly significant voting block. And, you know, the idea that we're going to study teacher salary for another 2 years, and the idea that, frankly, when you have 15,000 people worried about the future of education in Indiana and the governor can't pull himself out of his fat cat receptions in Florida to be there, says volumes about what his priorities are. So I think the teachers are aware of that disregard that he showed by not appearing at that rally. And then, if they keep mobilizing on this, I think they can have an effect because that's the only thing they'll listen to.
I want to ask about the fact that Governor Holcomb wasn't here in Indiana. Functionally, I mean, it's not like something was happening, you know, in the legislature or in the governor's office on Tuesday. But from a PR kind of standpoint, from a messaging standpoint, how bad did this look?
I think it was definitely an unforced error on their part. I mean, you know, he didn't have to spend all day there, but could he have walked through, shook some hands, listened to some teachers, made them feel like they're being listened to? Absolutely. And the fact that he, you know, had to jet down to Florida, as some people said, I wonder, you know, whose plane he took this time to the RGA. So I just think it was, you know, an easy thing to get around, and they just went with, you know, no, we're just not doing it.
Although being a president would carry with it some risk, it seems to me, too, because you can almost envision, even if he's not doing a formal presentation to the group or speaking at the rally, there would, in all likelihood, be some sort of exchange or encounter. And I could just see the video, which would be used over and over, which is, who's to say how these things unfold, but some sort of confrontation where teachers
That video already exists,
blaming
frankly.
Him.
Yeah. So, right. And it brings teachers?
Well, it brings it into a clear focus for from here to Election Day and beyond, where you have
focus.
It's
I saw
it's
a
teachers
number of lawmakers having
one-on-one discussions
with teachers, and they were all respectful and nice. And Lieutenant Governor Crouch had meetings inside her office, so there wouldn't
Speaker
be
Bosma,
video.
Senator Brink.
There were many ways to do that, and
right.
he chose
and
not
they
to.
Blew
I don't
them
know.
All.
The crowd in front of the chamber in the House was pretty aggressive. It felt like a labor union rally in front of during the session. When session was
right during
in,
the session, but every other
pretty,
period of the
it,
day, it really
the
wasn't
the formal
like that.
Rally where the speakers come. Yeah. And that was all good, but it got a little aggressive.
U.S. Ambassador Gordon Sondland, testifying in the House impeachment hearings this week, said Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo knew about President Trump's effort to pressure Ukraine for politically motivated investigations. Sondland says the president asked him in a phone conversation about the investigations he wanted the Ukrainians to launch, though the U.S. ambassador to the European Union also says Trump never explicitly spelled out the crux of the Ukraine affair. Sondland also implicated Mike Pence.
I just spoke up and I said it appears that everything is stalled until this statement gets made, something that words to that effect, and that's what I believe to be the case based on, you know, the work that the three of us had been doing, Volker, Perry, and myself, and the vice president nodded like, you know, he heard what I said, and that was pretty much it, as I recall.
The vice president's office quickly released a statement denying Pence and Sondland had ever spoken about the Ukraine affair. Nikki Kelly, I feel like I've asked this a few times, but functionally, does this mean anything in the grand scheme of things?
At least so far it isn't. I mean, the fact is there's no smoking gun, and that's what everyone's looking for, right? It's a he said, or a he said, she said. One person interpreted it this way, one person interpreted it that way. And, you know, at least polling-wise, I mean, people are either completely split down the middle, partisan, you know, Republican Democrat sides, or the independents are completely turning this off. So I don't think it's really helping or working the way the Democrats want.
I think there's perhaps more evidence than suggested there in terms of looking at the president's own words in the transcript that was released several weeks back.
And also when he goes on television.
And when he goes on television. I think there's a little bit more there. But I do agree with Nikki that because of the tribalism, political tribalism that we're dealing with now in our country and how polarized the atmosphere is, I don't think facts matter at this point. The hearings are producing, I think, adding to the framework of understanding, but to what end? And perhaps
right.
None.
So politically speaking, we've talked about are there going to be, you know, whether or not something happens in the House seems moot because nothing will happen in the Senate. So politically speaking, at the ballot box, is this come out a wash for both sides?
It's turning because I think the presidential candidates on the Democratic side are getting frustrated that it's wall-to-wall coverage of impeachment and not them. You know, 2 months before Iowa, some of them said that on the other night during the debate.
In part because the message
about Trump for the next 12 months, he's going to win.
Well, in part because, and they've been saying that well before impeachment hearings started too, is that we can't focus too much on President Trump. We have to focus more on what we want to
do.
And
it's the dullest impeachment hearing ever. We're talking about the same phone call and looking at it every which way, and there's no new facts. Even in this example, for this testimony, they asked if there was quid pro quo, and the answer was, well, I assume there was. It's like, well, all right, well, that's not an impeachable offense. Your assumption isn't impeachable. You weren't even in the room.
They've admitted it's a quid pro quo. What's ironic about this is you're right. The facts don't matter. I mean, first it didn't happen, and then, well, it happened, but it wasn't a quid pro quo. Well, now it's happened, and it is a quid pro quo, but it doesn't matter.
That's why the whole country's going, what?
Yeah, the smoking gun right. Is his behavior. I mean, it is clear that he went to, and I understand.
But does
I understand
it? But
the
functionally
politics.
Does it? Yeah, but does
I understand
it really
the politics.
Matter?
But I also remember that when Richard Nixon was facing this, the country was every bit as divided as they are now. And by the time he left office, it was 70% in favor of him going. Now, do I think they're going to remove him? No, because the Republicans are scared to death of him. They're scared to death of him, and he could do anything, and he will. What happened with this? The timing is Mueller comes out and supposedly exonerates him, and he makes the phone call the next day. What does he do after this? I mean, he has no regard for the law at all. And I don't think the Democrats, regardless of the political consequences, can say that that kind of conduct is okay. They can't.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice-Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, what effect are House impeachment hearings having on President Trump's chances at re-election? A positive effect, a negative effect, or little to none? Last week's question, are school districts right to cancel classes so teachers can attend a rally at the State House? 91% of you say yes, just 9% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana University Professor Eric Rasmussen, under fire for controversial tweets, is calling the university's response to the whole incident insulting. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Emma Atkinson reports.
IU Executive Vice President and Provost Lauren Rebell issued a statement Wednesday about the Kelley School of Business professor's tweets disparaging women in academia, calling his views, quote, racist, sexist, and homophobic. Rasmussen had tweeted, among other things, an article titled, Are Women Destroying Academia? Probably. Many responded by calling on the university to fire Rasmussen. In her statement, Rebell wrote that IU wouldn't and couldn't fire him without infringing on his First Amendment rights. IU says it will not force students to take Rasmussen's courses and will evaluate his grading for bias.
John Schwanis, I think you consider yourself somewhat of a First Amendment absolutist. Is IU doing, I would say, the right thing, but the only thing it can do here?
I think the First Amendment has served us well in this country. I'm never going to bet against it. It has a pretty good track record. I understand and sympathize with the challenge that Indiana University faced. You don't want to be known as the university that promotes hate and ignorance. You also have a lot of people, presumably including well-heeled alums and other benefactors who might withdraw support. I mean, those are the realities of it. That's on the one side of the scale. The other reality is he's a tenured professor, and if a university is going to be worth anything, it does need to stand up for freedom of expression, even expression that seems
repugnant
or certainly unwarranted. My thinking is there might be too much of a tendency in IU and everywhere else to protect the delicate ears of and sensibilities of students. I mean, if you can't have vigorous discussions in a university setting, where can you have them? And I think the best antidote to stupidity and ignorance is a full and robust discussion, because otherwise people sort of go through the motions of four-year education or beyond in grad school without ever actually having to defend their beliefs. I'd say have a colloquium on it.
Although the problem is that the conversation you're talking about, I mean, yes, but the conversation you're talking about is, on the one hand, women, LGBT people, and black people are stupider than everybody else, or they're not. And I don't think there's much of a discussion to be had there other than with Eric.
But you can still look at the challenge faced by universities and other employers
of
hate speech in the 21st century.
This provost statement was extensive. It felt like she was basically saying, if I could fire him, oh, man, I would.
Absolutely. I mean, I can tell she wants to. But, you know, it makes it very difficult in the private sector. Obviously, he would be gone. No. You know, you have different rules about...
Yeah, if this were Notre Dame, it would be different.
Yeah. Right.
But you know, what's interesting with Lauren Wrobel's statement is she said that nobody has to take that class. We're not requiring
that
anybody.
That would be the best.
It feels
class.
Like they no are like walling him off as much as they can.
Well, and they should. She could not do anything any differently. So, you know, she's made her feelings known.
Yes, they've done everything they can.
Yeah, I agree with everything that was said. Certainly would. What John went through, this guy. I mean, he has a history of this too. If you look at like old tweets, I mean, this isn't new. It's not a one-off.
The irony is, it's supposed to, with education, is supposed to become enlightenment. I hate to see what he was like before he was a professor.
All right. Well, Democratic presidential candidates met for the fifth primary debate this week, and South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, with newly minted frontrunner status, didn't have to defend against many attacks from his opponents.
Recent polls in Iowa and New Hampshire show Pete Buttigieg in the lead in those first two presidential contests, and that had many expecting the South Bend Democrat to have a target on his back in this week's debate. But there were few such moments. Buttigieg clashed with Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard again over foreign policy, and the 37-year-old fended off criticism from Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar about his experience level.
Washington experience is not the only experience that matters. There's more than 100 years of Washington experience on this stage. And where are we right now as a country?
Annalene, are you surprised Buttigieg didn't face more attacks from his opponents?
I'm actually not, because they've underestimated him consistently through this process. You know, they say, oh, this little guy from this little town in this little middle of nowhere state, we don't have to pay much attention to him because he's not from Washington. Well, he's shown that he can stand up there and go toe-to-toe with them on any issue, has substance in his proposals and everything else. And on one hand, they underestimate him. On the other hand, I think they're a little intimidated by him, frankly, because they're afraid that he's going to come back with an explanation that's much better than the attack.
But when it was Biden the front runner, everybody went after Biden. Then Elizabeth, Kamala Harris kind of rose for a little bit, and then everybody went after Harris. And then Elizabeth Warren surged, and everybody went after Elizabeth Warren. With Pete, is it just a matter of time now?
I don't think they know how to do it. I agree with Ann. I don't think they saw him coming. I think he just crushed fundraising. He's got this incredible ground game. There is risk in attacking the front runner too, especially the closer you get.
As we get closer and closer to Iowa,
and
it
he
feels
does
like...
fit because he's from Indiana. He does fit Iowa. I mean, and he said the problems aren't substantially different in Iowa than they are in Indiana.
Yeah, he'll face problems perhaps in South Carolina.
He is facing problems in South Carolina, right?
But he's got the resources to deal with it.
And as far left as the other front runners have gone, they're a much better fit in those other states, and he's not going to go there.
Yeah. Well, finally, next week is Thanksgiving, a time when many people often share what they're thankful for. Mike O'Brien, what are you thankful for this year in Indiana politics?
Sports betting, mobile sports gambling.
Oh, that's
a
good one.
If you haven't signed up yet, I'll send you a link. We'll both get some free play.
What are you thankful for this year in Indiana
I'm
politics?
I'm thankful the country survived another year with Donald Trump.
That's what you say.
Seriously.
Over there,
well, I'm...
It's survived another year.
I'm thankful that Indiana is not like Washington, D.C.
Yeah, me too.
You started with Brian Bosma. That's in there. I'd say leadership, smart leadership, from both parties in the General Assembly. We're blessed with that, I think, in Indiana.
Boy, I didn't think too much about this despite writing the question. I like yours.
I thought you were going to say that you had such a wonderful panel.
That's a perfect answer.
There you go.
What a great finish.
All right.
I agree.
That is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel, as great as they are, is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Have a happy Thanksgiving, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
I gotta be honest.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.